Yep, thank you.
So first, an announcement you should know about. The quiz is this Friday, and if you've done the homework, you should remember seeing each of the quiz problems and be able to dispute them. But if you haven't done the homework, the quiz could be extremely difficult, because the homework would be extremely difficult if you hadn't done it. It's not necessarily easy. Some of the problems are quite hard if you don't know anything about what's going on. Really impossible. So you definitely want to do the homework. Also, these are the general sort of grades that you should think of as corresponding to various scores in the midterm. So your most paranoid thought might be that A is between 90% and 100%, a B is between 80% and 90%, and so on. But it's not that bad. For example, so the average was about 20, and that's and C, which is supposed to mean average, look up the definition of C, is in fact right, you know, right around that. And 23 out of 34, that's a lot less than 80%. So these are just rough guides as far as letter grades go. That said, the way your actual score in the course will be computed is that it'll take into account your scores over the entire quarter, and then look at the average there, and then set a scale similar to this. This is just to give you a sense of whether or not you're doing well, okay? Yes?
How will the weighted average be computed? Do you create a percentage grade for each subcomponent, average them, and then make it take a letter grade at the
end? Oh, yeah, yes. So, for example,
do you do curves based on the entire year,
yes,
or for each individual assignment?
It's based on the entire quarter. The grades that are assigned at the end will be based on your average throughout the whole quarter. Things are not curved individually. Okay, any other questions about this? Also today I brought, in case you didn't get your exam back at section last night or in class on Friday, I have all of those remaining exams here. So there's a lot of people still who haven't got their exams back. Has anybody here not got your exam back yet? Okay, a lot of people here. So at the end of class, come up and I have your exams ordered in alphabetical order, ready to go, okay? All right, what today is about is, well, the name is trigonometric substitutions. And it's actually a pretty amazing and very natural technique for doing certain integrals that you might not know how to do now. So if you look at the homework for section 7.3, the very first problem asks you to compute the definite integral from square root of 2 to 2 of 1 divided by x cubed square root of x squared minus 1 dx. And if you look at this for a while, you might get pretty frustrated because it doesn't really seem to fall naturally into any of the types of integrals that you may know how to compute so far. You can try to do a substitution, maybe u equals x squared minus 1, but then du would be 2x dx. And there's not a 2x sitting right here. So the most obvious substitution at least doesn't really work for you. You have this really annoying x cubed document. Notice this is square root, and this is an x cubed, not x times cube root. Just let me emphasize that. I'll do that by putting parentheses here. So how do you do this integral? You could try integration by parts, maybe separating it into 1 over x cubed and 1 over square root of x squared minus 1. But if you try that, already it's just kind of scary to contemplate doing that. But if you actually do try it, you don't really get anywhere. So that doesn't work so well. However, if you read ahead, you'll know that there's a really clever substitution you can make. But it's not, let me emphasize several times, it's not the same as the u substitutions you've done before. So it's called an inverse substitution. And in some ways, it's much more natural and easy than the substitutions you've done already. But you haven't seen it so far. But it's what we're going to be talking about today. And this method is potentially applicable not only in the context of something where you have a square root and where you use a trig substitution. It's something that you could use a lot more generally. I don't know why I haven't done it so far, but it's called an inverse substitution. It's really nice. And It's going to make this integral surprisingly easy. Not easy, but surprisingly easy. Okay, so this is what it's called. And here's how it works. First, I'll just tell you kind of the general method, and then I'll give you a little strategy for dealing with things of this form. So the general fact is simply the following. If you have an integral from, well, first I'll do an indefinite integral. If you have an indefinite integral f of x dx, this is the same thing as f of g of t, g prime of t, dt. Where here, you just choose some function g of t, any function at all, say x is equal to g of t. Now, for this to be true, you want that g is 1 to 1 and r2. So let's just, well, let's just say g is 1 to 1. So what? G to be 1 to 1. But if you have that, then you have this equality. And it's very natural from the notation. If you let x be g of t, then you stick it in there, and then dx would be g prime of t dt. And the usual substitution that we've already done, the u substitutions, that goes in the other direction. You notice that some part of it is of this form, so you replace that by u, and then you notice that the other remaining part is the du. So this is just kind of going in the forward direction. It's in some sense easier than the other one. You don't have to spot anything special. You just replace your x by some other function, and the dx accordingly gets replaced exactly as the notation suggests, and you get another integral. One thing that you have to watch out for, this thing on the right is expressed in terms of t. So get something where you have equality, this is in terms of x and this is in terms of t, you want to rewrite this in terms of t. So you want to evaluate this at, g inverse of x. So you want to solve for t in terms of x and then substitute that back in. Does this make any sense? Certainly seems natural given the notation. You want to integrate f of x dx and you have x as a function of something else, then you replace x by that, and you replace dx by g prime of t dt. It's like a change of variables. And there's also a definite version of this, just like with u substitutions, there was a definite version. But the way the endpoints change is exactly the opposite of before. So you have to be really careful. So if you have an integral from a to b of f of x dx, and this is equal to integral from g inverse of a to g inverse of b of f of g of t, g prime of t, dt. And just as kind of a consistency check that this makes sense, notice that as t varies from g inverse of a to g inverse of b, the values that you're plugging in here, well, what you're plugging into f is g of g inverse of a through g of g inverse of b. So the inputs to the f here vary from a to b, just like they did before. So when you integrate from a to b here, you're running over exactly the same range of values as if you integrate from g inverse of a to g inverse of b over here. And this extra g prime of t just compensates for how you've changed your coordinates in here. So this might seem like, you know, why bother with this? But you may, yes, please.
So then we don't need that extra g inverse?
Well, here on both sides you just get a number. Here, this is a real number. Here, this is, again, a number. So it's, see, here I'm telling you how to compute an antiderivative. And so it would be nice to write the antiderivative in x on both sides. When you do this, you'll get some function, capital F of x. That's an antiderivative. Here, you'd also like something in terms of x, since you want an antiderivative. And in order to do that, you need to do something, because if you just computed the thing in parentheses, it's in terms of t. But you know, the natural thing, if you had something in terms of t and you wanted to get it in terms of x, would be to write t equal g inverse of x. And that inverse exists because of this condition. See, x equals g of t implies that g inverse of x is equal to t. Okay? Now, again, this is going to seem really worthwhile to know when I show you how to use this to just deal with integrals like this and a whole bunch of other ones. Okay, again, any questions though? You can also apply this in some other situations. For example, if you had something like f of x plus 2, and you wish that the plus 2 wasn't there, you could use a transformation like this. But again, let me emphasize, this is totally backwards to the usual u substitution. Instead of finding something in here and setting it equal to u, I'm writing x as a function of something else and substituting that in for x, and then making sure to change the dx accordingly, and potentially the limits of integration. So you have to be careful not to get confused, because this is just exactly the opposite of the other substitution. Now I'm going to illustrate the power of this. I'm going to take this scary looking integral and make it easier. And there's a table in the book that has a couple of things in it, and I think it's going to be so important in this lecture that I'll just copy it right up here. So here's an expression. I'll just give you the first line for now. Actually, keep this exactly the same as in the book. I'll give you the last line, since that will be the one relevant to computing that integral. Square root of x squared minus a squared. Over there we have square root of x squared minus 1. That's an expression that appears in the integral. And this is, the table gives something a little bit more general, which is why I put it in. The substitution to use, the inverse substitution, is a secant theta. And there's some, you have to be careful about the limits where you consider this. And the reason that you do this, the motivation for this whole business, is the following trig identity. Secant squared theta minus 1 is equal to tangent squared theta. The fact that secant squared theta minus 1 equals tangent squared theta means that over here, if you replace x by secant, then you get a secant squared right here, minus 1. And that's tangent squared. And you're taking square root of tangent squared. So you just end up with this scary looking thing being replaced by a much nicer thing, tangent. The square roots are all gone. It's really nice. That's maybe what you'd want to do anyways. Replace x by something so that this thing in the bottom gets replaced by something really nice. The question is, what happens to everything else? The answer is given right here. This is what happens to everything else. The notation of calculus, namely that dx gets replaced by g prime of t dt, is amazing, because that's exactly what happens. This is the change that you get. So the notation exactly tells you the right thing to do. Though, of course, you should carefully prove it. So let's do it. So all I'm going to do is apply what's listed right here with, so I'll say x equals secant of theta. And then dx, what's the derivative of secant?
Secant tangent.
Okay. Secant theta, tangent theta, d theta. So amazingly, all I have to do, I'll take this, and I just use my listed there, and we'll get something else that will be much nicer. And there'll be something similar in each of the following cases. Square root of a squared minus x squared, and square root of a squared plus x squared. In each case, there's a simple substitution similar to this one. You do it, you use that formula, and assuming you just have one thing of that form that you're doing, you end up getting something over here where the square root just disappears, and you're left with some nice trig function to integrate. And you know a lot about doing that from last time. Okay, so let's do it in this case. So first, we have to adjust our limits of integration. Instead of going from square root of 2 to 2, well, we go from g inverse. So let's see, what is the g here? It's secant of theta. So it's secant, so we go from secant inverse of root 2, thank you very much, to secant of 2. I think I'm going to make a purposeful mistake in writing down the rest of the integral, since I have so many copies of the notes to give away and I'm not feeling very error-prone.
You forgot the inverse of secant.
There it is. Good job. I'm not feeling error-prone. There was an error on the board. Drop my word. Great, so now what do we put inside? Well, it's just our function, but with x replaced by what we're replacing x by. So that's 1 divided by secant cubed of theta times square root of secant squared theta minus 1, which makes us very happy because secant squared minus 1 is tangent squared. And we're going to get a square root of a square. And then d theta, can't forget that. So d theta, well, or rather dx, I'm just copying this, but with x replaced by secant of theta, dx replaced by d secant of theta, which is the same thing as secant of theta, tangent of theta, d theta. Okay? This is great. I've written down another integral. It's completely equivalent to the original one, but this one's going to be much, much easier. It doesn't look easier yet, but watch for a second. So first, let's deal with the endpoint. So secant, well, secant is just 1 over cosine. Notice it's basically cosine spelled backwards. So we have to find some angle theta so that 1 over cosine of theta is equal to square root of 2. That is to say, cosine of theta is equal to 1 over square root of 2. So what's the value of theta whose cosine is 1 over root 2?
45.
Sure, 45 degrees or pi over 4. Now it's very important you do it in radians because you have to do it consistently. And you have to make a choice of either degrees or radians in the whole theory. And if you choose degrees, you have certain formulas that work out in certain ways. If you choose radians, they're different. And in here, we always choose radians. So use radians. So pi over 4 here. What about here? So you do the same thing, except instead of a root 2, in what I just did, you'll have a 2. So what angle do you get 1 half for? So if you don't remember, you can try drawing a triangle.
Pi over 3.
That's right. That is definitely right. Pi over 3. But let me just, let's see. 3. Triangle to draw. So I want it to be 1 half. So I guess it's 9. All right. Yeah. So that's the triangle where that's pi over 3. So this is pi over 3. And now let's deal with the inside. Now this looks like a mess, but this simplifies a lot. Yes, please.
Why are we doing 1 over cosine?
Just because that's the definition of secant. Secant of x is by definition 1 over cosine of x.
Sorry, finding
the I'm just trying to evaluate the boundaries. So the answer to the question is yes, we're finding the boundaries. That's all we're doing. Okay? And again, as a memory aid, notice that secant is cosine spelled backwards, except for the e. Which helps upside down backwards. Helps me. Okay, so first there's some cancellation. That secant and that secant cubed cancel. So we have tan theta, and down here we have secant squared theta, and then here we have square root of tangent squared because of our trig identity, and that's tangent of theta. Now you have to be careful that the square root of this, that this is always positive, so that this is an absolute value of tangent theta on this integral. But let's look in here. So those two cancel, and look, we're just left with the integral of d theta over secant squared theta. And again, secant of theta is by definition 1 over cosine of theta. So you can rewrite this as integral from pi over 4 to pi over 3 of cosine squared theta d theta. And that probably looks familiar. It's the sort of thing that you know kind of almost how to do automatically. You write cosine squared as 1 half 1 plus cos 2 theta. D theta. And then this one's, now we're really set. So we have 1 half, and then the inside theta plus 1 half sine 2 theta.
We're going from Piover 4 to Piover 3. And now we just have to get some more blackboard space. Go up here. So this is 1/2 pi over 3 plus, so it is sine of 2 pi over 3. It's 1/2, I think. So that's 1/4. And then minus pi over 4 minus, now sine of pi over 2 is just 1, so minus 1/2. And now you just have some algebra. So this is 1/2 times 4 minus 3, 1, or pi over 12, 1/4 minus 1/2.
Are you sure sine of 2 pi over 3 is 1/2?
No.
Yeah,
that's okay. So, pi over 3. I guess my triangle tells me right here that it's 3 over 2. So the other two means to that. Okay, so pi over 12 here, and then I mean, it's just that's what it is. Maybe I won't bother simplifying further, but I will check that I have the same thing as my notes. And at this point, I have exactly what's in my notes, which is a good sign. Okay, so step back. So any step that any of you don't understand about going from the left-hand side of the board all the way over there, think about it. I'll wait a second. Give me a chance. Yes.
Could you go ahead and calculate, like, directly sine 2 pi over 3?
Okay. Okay, so sine 2 pi over 3.
That's what you did directly. Oh, no.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Okay.
Sine is an, it's, if you have an angle like this, you can consider the corresponding angle right here, pi over 3. That's what this triangle has here. This is pi over 3. And then sine is opposite over hypotenuse, root 3 over 2. So I actually used this triangle I had before, which I used for computing inverse cosine. Okay, any other questions? Okay, now there are a couple of other trig identities, and you can use exactly the same inverse substitution technique to deal with several other types of integrals. Namely, if you encounter an integral that has square root of a squared minus x squared, well, there you use x equals a sine theta. And the reason that's a good idea is because 1 minus sine squared theta is equal to cosine squared theta. Likewise, here you use x equals a tan theta. And the reason, again, is because 1 plus, it's almost the, it's the same identity as down here, but written differently. 1 plus tan squared theta is equal to secant squared theta. Okay, so if you're computing an integral and it has one of these three expressions in it, just one, if it had two of them, if it had both this one and that one, you wouldn't know which one to use. You couldn't. I mean, you can't use both of them at once. But if you have exactly one of these three, and the rest of the integral isn't too complicated, then you may be lucky and this technique will work, as it did here. And it's very powerful. It's a new thing you haven't quite seen before. And it's pretty straightforward to apply. The key thing, though, is just really knowing about these two trig identities and having the clever idea that you can use them to replace a square root of something like this by a square root of a perfect square. Hence, getting rid of the square completely. I mean, getting rid of the square root completely. Okay, so that's the general idea. Any questions? So now I'm just going to spend the rest of the time today showing you additional examples to illustrate various things that come up with each of these techniques.
in various cases. So I've illustrated one completely now, and I'll show you some more. Before you get exhausted by the lecture, the key things are the following. One, sometimes you'll get something that kind of looks like this, but there's a coefficient of x in it. What do? You complete the square. You can just rewrite it as something that, where the x disappears, it's still, it's a square of something. It might not be x squared, it might be x plus 2 squared or something like that. But via completing the square, you can deal with that. So that's one key thing. Anything else? I think that's really the one other key thing that I need to be clear about. That's really all there is to it. So
you have to know to use each of these and know to use completing the square.
So I think probably since that's the one other key thing, I'm going to make sure that I do it before you get tired, and I'll do an example that involves completing the square.
Also, this next example I'll do with no limits of integration given, and that will illustrate how you have to change back. You get this integral that's formally in terms of some other variable. You want something in terms of x again, you have to change back. Now, remember with u substitution, changing back was easy. You got something in terms of u, and you just did a very simple operation. You substituted what u was equal to, and you got back the answer. Here, substituting back at the end and getting back into your original variables, that's the hard part, since this is, again, inverse substitution. Yes?
Can't you just substitute, u equals arc sine of a?
Yes, but that's ugly, and you want to get something nice looking. So you'll do that, and you get some messy expression, which can be simplified a lot, and that's what you want to do. And again, I'm only saying that it's hard because it can be somewhat difficult to compute arcsine in a nice way. So if you have some function g, it might be more complicated to compute g inverse. If you had to compute arcsine of something, you might be less happy than if you computed sine of something. That's all. So it's almost as straightforward, it's just that there's an inverse here. And you have the potential to get confused because of that inverse. I really don't want anyone to ever get confused about that. All right, so here's another example. This example will illustrate how to use completing the square, and it will illustrate not having endpoints for your integration. So here's the example. Compute the integral and antiderivative of square root of 5 plus 4x minus x squared dx. Okay. This looks somewhat like the expressions appearing in the table on the right. So you'll think, okay, inverse substitution is the way to go. But it's not exactly one thing in the table over there. So you use the idea of completing the square to make it something like that over there. So first, 5 plus, well, actually I'll do it all at once. So rewrite this as integral square root of dx. Now, what I'll do is, let's see. So, it's going to be minus x plus something squared, and then we'll have, actually, 5 minus x plus something, we have to fill in the blank, squared, plus something that exactly cancels out, but we fill in the blank. So you just have to figure out what to stick there so that the thing you get here is 5 plus 4x minus x squared. Also, another little loop I'm throwing you for is that it's completing a square where the coefficient of x squared is negative. 2? Okay. So you're right. The thing you stick here is always half the coefficient of x. Yep, so what do you get when you square it out? You get 4, and you need to make sure to make up for that by subtracting off of it. All right. Something's wrong, actually. The problem is this should be minus 2. And then this is...
can you pull out negative 1?
See, the sign of these have to be different, so I could pull out negative 1. In any case, I'm going to fiddle around for a minute, I'm going to get something, and then we're going to check that it works. And that's all that matters.
Yes, you could.
So x squared minus 4x plus 2, subtracting that off, so I better put plus 4 here, because I want to get something that's equal.
So I fill in this blank, fill in that blank as it must be, and now at this point, notice that it works. This is equal to that. You just multiply it up and you can check. Here you have x squared minus 4x plus 4. And when you have that, when you take the minus sign into account, that gives you minus x squared. The minus 4x in here corresponds to the plus 4x. And then the thing left over is, you have a plus 4 here with the minus sign. It's minus 4, and you exactly make up for that by adding 4 there. So you get 9, and there's the minus 4, and you got 5, blah, 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 blah. In any case, I completed this part. People are probably not happy with my unclear explanation. So okay. By factoring out the minus sign and then just
show that you did a plus two, minus one.
So it's very important. Somebody yelled out, factor out the minus one and then do it the long way. So I'll do it again. 5 minus x squared minus 4x. Okay? I just factored out the minus one. Now just complete the square here by dividing by 2 and then adding the other thing. So this is 5 minus, and inside, x minus 2 quantity squared. That's how you complete the square. You add on half of that, and then there's a plus 4, so you subtract out 4. Okay? That's all it is. And now if you copy this down here, you see that they're the same thing. Is it good?
Okay.
Two thumbs up all over the room. It's good. Okay, so what are we going to let x equal? Okay, let's do that. We have this inverse substitution method. We can apply it anytime you, well, here, I mean, we just use a normal substitution here, actually. As he said, let's let u be x minus 2. Okay? Then you get integral of square root of 5 minus u squared. What's du? This is normal substitution, not inverse substitution. Du is just dx. So it's very nice. You put du here. Okay, this is just normal substitution, the first technique you learned. Unless I messed up and our right hand
suggested
it.
It was supposed to be 9.
See, you yelled it out.
See, why are the people
Karen, Karen, you had your hand up.
I think we yelled it out simultaneously, so give us a
point
because I've already got one.
Karen,
that's
a girl, not
you. Okay, Karen. That's what you were going to say, right? And your name's Karen. Okay. Be about it. Okay, so now this looks really similar to what's over there, right? So now all we just do it, now we do is, now all we do is figure out which one of these we fall into. Looks like this one. So we'll use the substitution u equals a sine theta. But now this is an inverse substitution, so be careful. Inverse substitution. We're going to let u equal 3 sine theta. And then du is 3 cos theta d theta. I really hope you don't get confused by the fact that this is different. I'm not letting u be something I already see up here. I'm letting it be something new that I wish were up here. Whereas here, I let u be x minus 2, something that was already here. Again, in both cases, the notation exactly by 2, but you have to be careful to understand the difference. So this is integral square root of, I simply replace the u by 3 sine theta, so 9 minus 9 sine squared theta. And then du is 3 cos theta d theta. Now just as, again, a consistency check, imagine that you're asked to integrate this. You might think, hey, look, I see a 3 sine theta here, and then I see the derivative of that here. I could do a substitution and see that this is equal to that. So it's just like you've gone backwards one step. You could, if this had been what you started with, you could have used the old substitution method that, you know, a normal substitution, you go from here to here. That's why this. That's why you can go in the other direction. You can go in either direction. If you can see using a normal substitution that this is equal to that, then certainly this is equal to that. Okay? So this is simply, it's what you already know how to do by going up the page rather than down. Except now I'm going down. Okay, now we're in great shape because there's a trig identity. Cos squared plus sine squared equals 1. So we can rewrite this without any square roots or squares. And then we're in excellent shape. So here I'll factor out the 3's, and there's also 3 over there, so I'll put a 9 out here. This is square root of 1 minus sine squared theta. And then, of course, there's this cosine theta d theta. And that's 9 integral 1 minus sine squared is cos squared. Square root of that is cosine, so it's cosine squared theta d theta. Did I mess up?
Well, I want to do theta. 9.
The factor of the square root of 9.
Yeah, but I think I did. There's a square root of 9 here that gives me a 3. There's also a 3 over here. Yeah. Is this right? There's so much worry that I better check with my notes. This is what I have in my notes. And now, does the problem of computing an integral of cosine squared seem at all familiar? Yes, that's exactly the same thing that we did over here. You know how to do it. An antiderivative is theta plus a half sine 2 theta. We found one right here. Except, oh, there's a half on the front. So we know an antiderivative. Again, by using that cosine of 2 theta, or sorry, cosine squared of theta is 1 plus cos 2 theta all over 2. Okay, so now we're confronted with the not too intimidating integral cosine squared theta d theta. And again, using exactly what I did a few minutes ago, write this as 1 plus cos 2 theta d theta. And now I get really excited because this is 9 halves theta plus 1 half sine 2 theta. And I am going to remember to keep it constant. And there we are. We're not quite done, because the original question asked us to compute an integral in terms of x. And our answer, well, it's really far away. I mean, we have a u substitution here, and then there's something else going on here. There are two substitutions we did on the way here. So we have to get everything back in terms of x. So be careful. Yes, please.
Why is it a 9 out front instead of 3?
Because there's a 3 here. Just pull that out. But then there's another 3 here. Or rather, a square root of 9. Okay, so there's 2 3's, which together make 9, when multiplied. Okay, so there we are. That's almost the answer, but I want to write it in terms of x. So here, you have two things to do. So you have, from that, you have u over 3 equals sine of theta. And u over 3, well, u is equal to x minus 2. So u over 3 is x minus 2 over 3. So sine of theta is x minus 2 over 3. Therefore, theta is sine inverse of x minus 2 over 3. It's just what Stefan said. Why don't you just put arcsine there? Why don't you just take the inverse? This implies that theta is arcsine or sine inverse. They're exactly the same thing, synonyms, of x minus 2 over 3. So in this formula right here, all I have to do is everywhere substitute for theta, sine inverse of x minus 2 over 3. And in some cases, I might be able to simplify what I get a little bit. So the fact of the matter is, when you compute indefinite integrals that come from things that look like this, you're going to have a lot of arcsines, whatever. You're going to have a lot of inverse trigonometric functions appearing in the answer. That's just what's true. Integrals of squares like this, they're actually measuring areas of ellipses, or pieces of ellipses, or skewed ellipses. And it's not surprising that when you compute the areas of things that are like ellipses, you're going to end up with some trigonometric functions in the answer. Okay, so finally, let's do it. We know what theta is equal to in terms of x. We want this to be an x, and you have a question.
Yeah. So how does it get from On the second line, the third line here?
From this line to this line?
Yeah.
So this is a separate line, and here's what I did. Here, here's a relation between u and theta. U equals 3 sine theta. There's a relation between u and x. You just use those together. So this, I divided both sides of this by 3. That gave me sine of theta equals u over 3. But I really wanted things in terms of x. And this is, this u in terms of x is x minus 2. So that's where that's how I went from here to here. So the first one comes from the first orange circle thing. And the second equality comes from the second orange circled equality. OK? Any questions? All right. All right, so now 9/9 sine inverse. I like writing sine inverse better for some reason. Of x minus 2 over 3 plus 1/2. It's actually going to be kind of annoying having sine inverse of 2, I mean, sorry, having sine of 2 of sine inverse of x minus 2 over 3. Yes, Stefan?
I think I can simplify that. We just use the double angle formula, and then you can rewrite cosine of arc sine as the square root of 1 of 1.
Wait, hold on, hold on, hold on. Which thing do you want to simplify?
The right-hand side.
This?
Yeah.
Okay, so write this as, the double angle formula says that's 2 sine theta cos theta, which it's just going to make us very happy because we're going to plug in sine inverse right here. That's a constant. So that was the first thing you suggested. Okay, now what?
And because sine squared plus cos squared is equal to 1, we can easily rewrite cosine in terms of sine and thus in terms of x.
Oh, with the square root, but you're right. Oh, wait, no. What do you want to do with this? What do you want to do with this? I didn't understand.
Rewrite it as the square root of 1 minus sine squared.
Okay. Sine squared theta. Sure. And now we can write this as, I'm not opposed. Actually, I like that, right? So plus sine of sine inverse. I'm going to write it all out. Sine inverse of x minus 2 over 3 times, we replace cosine of theta by square root of 1 minus sine square root of sine inverse of x minus 2 over 3. Okay, and now we're happy because we have a bunch of things that are like sine of sine inverse. So it'll be easy to deal with this. I'm missing a constant and a constant. Okay. So this is 9/2. Something I can do with sine inverse x minus 2 over 3, except leave it like that. Plus now sine of sine inverse, such as x minus 2 over 3. And the last one, square root of 1 minus, so sine squared of this, so think of that as this whole thing evaluated and squared. So sine of sine inverse of x minus 2 over 3 is x minus 2 over 3. And then that's squared. So that's it. We've computed an antiderivative of the function square root of 5 plus 4x minus x squared. Yes?
Do you have to do that extra step? Or do you just plug sine inverse of x minus 2 over 3 into the double angle formula? In the sine of 2 over 3.
Directly here?
No, over
here.
Oh. Here, right there.
You could plug in sine inverse here, but it might be frustrating because then you have sine of 2 times sine inverse of something. And it's kind of hard to then see how to get the sine and sine inverse to cancel out. That's all. Does that answer your question enough? But you could. I mean, you could stick at any, I mean, as soon as you get here, you could put what theta is in and you get a true statement. It's just not as eloquent. Whereas this is pretty nice in the sense it's all just in terms of x and possibly some square roots, but it's a clean answer. It's as clean as you can hope for, at least.
So I hope that answers your question. It's really a matter of taste. Yes?
Oh, never mind. Figure it out.
What did you figure out? Maybe you can tell us.
Sine inverse is canceled out.
Yep. A function f, if you have a function f and another function f inverse, f of f inverse of x is x. Yes, in the back. Here? This one. How I got this. Okay, so let me think. How did we get that? What I used was that cosine squared theta plus sine squared theta is equal to 1. Then I took in this formula, I forgot the theta here, I solved for cosine. This implies that cosine of theta is square root of 1 minus sine squared theta. And then here, where I have a cosine theta, I simply replaced it by square root of 1 minus sine squared theta. And then that's what I used here. So this is square root of 1 minus sine of theta quantity squared. Sine squared theta is the same thing as sine of theta quantity squared. Alternatively, you could, and this is what's written down in my notes, instead of doing this, you could leave it as cosine of sine inverse of what was it? X minus 2 over 3. And you could then write down a triangle which has two of its sides, x minus 2 and 3, and some other side which will involve a square root using the Pythagorean theorem. And then you find the cosine of the angle for that triangle using the definitions. That's an alternative way. It's what I wrote down in my notes. And it also gives you this. It should give exactly the same answer.
Maybe I'll check that just to make sure. But there's a mysterious 9.
Yeah, I get exactly the same thing in my notes.
So this is good.
And I actually like what Stefan suggested, which is just to solve for cosine of theta in terms of sine. You end up with exactly the same answer, but you don't have to worry about drawing little triangles in the margin. But you could also do that too. You get the same thing. They're both equally valid ways to go.
Can you solve that little part out?
Wait, sorry, say that again. Start from
the last part. Like,
yes.
That little part from the solve.
Oh, just trying. The other way to do it?
Yeah.
Sure, I'll show you how to do that. And that will be the last thing that I do today. Though, I encourage you to look at the notes I typed up, which have a number of other nice examples to look at. And I have a few copies left, which you can maybe grab again. Okay, so for this, we just have to write down a right triangle, two of whose side lengths are x minus 2 and 3, and such that the sine of this angle theta is x minus 2 over 3. So I guess, see, sine is the adjacent. Wait, yeah, sine is adjacent over hypotenuse.
Sine is the opposite of hypotenuse because of that definition. Yep. Sine 0 is 1.
I agree completely. I'm being tired, but and you don't get another sheet. So what goes here? You have a right triangle. You have two of the sides. Theta is by definition the right triangle with two of the sides like this. What is the third side? Use the Pythagorean theorem, and it tells you. The square of this plus the square of this side is that. So what you put here is square root of the longer side. So the square root is 3 squared minus x minus 2 squared. That's the third side. Now the cosine of this angle is the adjacent angle over the hypotenuse. And that's exactly what here, right here, if you deal with the 3. So the cosine of theta, this is equal to square root of the adjacent over the hypotenuse. Okay, and if you divide this by 9, you end up with this, the same thing. In other words, write 3 as square root of 9, and then combine together the square root, and you end up with square root of 1 minus x minus 2 over 3 squared. Okay? That's the other way to do this. And either one's completely valid. They're really exactly the same thing. The fact that cos squared plus sine squared equals 1 is exactly encoding the property of the right triangle theorem. It's just the Pythagorean theorem written out trigonometrically. Okay, so I'll stop just on time. I'll see you on Friday for the quiz.
I have any exams that you haven't got yet. And if you want homework, or if you want notes, I have some quick notes. Okay, what's your name? Sorry.
Christina.
Okay, what's your last name?
Rodriguez.
That's the real thing I need. Christina.
I studied really hard, but
believe it, surely
yeah,
you know
that. I don't have time, so I feel kind of
yeah.
I noticed that it was the same exact thing as yeah. practice method. I should have just copied it out of my notes.
Yeah.
Okay. So my friend told
okay, yes.
I was like, dollar.
Okay, scholar?
Maybe not.
Okay, here's yours.
Yeah, well, I knew that, so I did some examples, but I didn't copy
anything. Sorry. Thanks, that was it.
Right
there.
Put,
yeah.
Okay. Yep. So, Clayman.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Oops. Who wants their exam? You?
Yang. Yang.
Yang.
Probably one of the last ones.
Yep. Zhang, Zhang or Yang?
No, Yang, Y-A-N-G.
Yep, here we are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Something I hate.
I don't know
your
last name.
It's Zhang, Z-H-A-N-G.
So I have
to start.
Wait,
but the
division
is
not
Lou, L-E-W. Okay.
My kiss was all the way at
9.
L-E-W.
Louis,
L-E-W.
So what's one? Laura Levy?
Yep.
Maybe Laura.
I tried hard to
one. So,
S-O.
S-O?
Yeah.
Why do you need
the
moving part?
I thought I could handle it. If the physics quiz wasn't on Tuesday,
Sanko, Sanko, yeah.
Sanko.
Andrew?
Yeah. Cool. So can I take this copy of the notes? Yeah.
Well, this copy.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Andrew.
Your last Kravas. Name is in. Your last name is
Kravas.
Kravas. Okay.
Question?
Yes.
If you could, like,
have probably, sure. But let me finish this and then go outside because there's really class coming. But I'd love to talk to you as long as you want. So
the thing that's made me really curious is like how do we know that the things like e to the x squared don't have an elementary antiderivative?
Is
there a reasonably simple way to tell you when to give up?
No, that's a very difficult problem. There is a decision procedure. I don't know if it's been implemented completely.